This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing the latest developments in Baghdad, but before we continue with that story, we're joined by NPR's Jennifer Lutton. She's fresh out of a Pentagon briefing with Pentagon spokeswoman Victoria Clark, the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Public Affairs, and the Vice Chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Stanley McChrystal. Jennifer, thanks for joining us.
Hi there, Neil.
First, any news on the attack that was apparently targeted at Saddam Hussein?
Not really. Major General Stanley McChrystal basically said we have a big hole in the ground there now. We are confident, speaking for the military, that it's exactly where the military intended the hole to be, but there's no hard assessment, he said, on who exactly was in the building when it was hit.
Now, in the recent days, they've been talking about Saddam Hussein being more and more irrelevant, yet they continue to try to find him, reach out to him, as some would say. Is he regarded as the key to victory?
Yeah, well, as you said, they keep being asked this question. If you haven't gotten him, how do you know you've won if you don't have Saddam Hussein? And they do continue to downplay his importance, saying it doesn't matter. The regime is collapsing anyway. Major McChrystal essentially said, look, you know, this is like the questions we were asked 10 days ago when we seemed to be in a pause and weren't we getting bogged down and it was Vietnam and then suddenly we zoomed up to Baghdad. Just give it time, he said. It's extraordinary when you stand back and look what the military has achieved. He said, we are in the center of Baghdad. U.S. soldiers, he said, are spending the night wherever they want in Baghdad. The U.S. has total air dominance over the entire country, and there is no coherent Iraqi defense. So regardless of Saddam Hussein's position, the regime is coming to an end, even if he said it's too early to exactly define how you'll know when it's gone. However, Major McChrystal did say that Saddam Hussein, were he to remain alive, could play an important role in keeping going these, what the military calls death squads, these paramilitary groups who've been sniping in guerrilla-style attacks on U.S. forces.
Well, what about another of the leading personalities of the regime, Ali Hassan al-Majid, the cousin of Saddam Hussein, better known perhaps as a Chemical Ali, reported killed in Basra the other day?
It sounded stronger yesterday when we were told this by officials. They say they haven't really backed down, that they were only claiming optimism about his death. Today they repeated they are optimistic that he is dead, but not a confirmation. And it's hard to imagine. Well, I guess he's in his house is down near Basra, presumably. It's unclear to me whether or not British or American soldiers could go to the site to do this confirmation. Obviously, you're talking forensic tests and so forth, so but no confirmation yet.
And what about the potential cache of perhaps chemical weapons, perhaps pesticides that we heard about yesterday?
Also, a bit of a backing down there. We were told test results are mixed, but ongoing, and no hard proof yet.
Now, there was another development yesterday, and that involved the arrival of several hundred Iraqi exiles who say they're ready to fight.
Right, and apparently, according to reporters traveling with them, are armed already. So the question was put today, if you've got several hundred armed Iraqis in central Iraq, southern Iraq, aren't they going to be seen as targets for American and British troops? And essentially, what we were told is that the U.S. is arming them and training them, not clear exactly for what purpose, but that they are, for the moment, being kept in something of a contained area, safe, not in harm's way, so that they won't be mistaken as a target of the U.S. Army.
Mm-hmm. And were they installed there with the idea that they would be the core of a new Iraqi government?
That's what we did not get a clear answer on. It's, we were asked, what is their role? We asked General McChrystal and Tory Clark, what will their role be? Not a strong answer there.
And finally, Jennifer, let me ask you about the two separate incidents in which reporters were killed in Baghdad today. A tank attack, and we heard a little bit about that earlier, on the Palestine Hotel, where many reporters are staying, and an apparent airstrike on the offices of Al Jazeera, the Arabic language cable outlet.
Right. Tory Clark and both General McChrystal said that there is an inherent right of self-defense on the part of the U.S. military. In fact, there's an obligation, they said, when they come under fire to defend themselves. The question was put that apparently one presumes the military knew that journalists were in at least the Palestine Hotel where two camera people were killed. you know, if as the Army claims, there were small arms coming from there, is it within the orders given that you respond with tank fire if you know there are unarmed civilians in there? And really, they didn't give a straight answer. They just kept invoking the right to self-defense and stressing that they have taken, they say, great care in a number of instances that they've told us about and that media have reported on themselves of to avoid civilian casualties. Apparently, journalists in the hotel say they did not hear outgoing fire, so there seems to be some dispute as to the small arms fire that the Army claims it took from the hotel.
Yeah, we were talking with Craig Nelson earlier of Cox Newspapers, who was there and says there was no, he's heard no reports of any, and he certainly didn't see any himself.
A hotel full of journalists who missed that, I'm not sure, but I can't speak, I'm not there. I would accept it's a very confusing situation, but basically, the only comment here was that there's a right to self-defense and the soldiers did exercise caution.
Jennifer Ludden, thanks very much.
Thank you.
NPR's Jennifer Ludden with us from our cubicle at the Pentagon. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. American armored columns carve through different parts of Baghdad to seize new areas, including an important military airfield. Defenders mount local counterattacks and put up bitter resistance, but U.S. commanders say the counterstrikes are uncoordinated and that Iraq may have fewer than a dozen tanks left. As military and civilian casualties mount, hospitals are reported running out of basic supplies. There is no word on whether Saddam Hussein and his sons were killed in an airstrike yesterday. No word either on whether drums of chemicals found at an agricultural site are chemical weapons or pesticides. Three journalists died in Baghdad today. At the Palestine Hotel, some reporters say they were targeted needlessly by a U.S. tank. At the Al Jazeera office, some say an American airstrike was deliberate. In Basra, British officials have placed a local tribal leader in charge in hopes of a quick restoration of order. As British forces take control of that big southern city, they have done little to control widespread looting and, residents say, have not done enough to bring them food and especially clean water. Over the course of this hour, we'll bring you what we know about the humanitarian situation in Iraq, how the military is fighting the Battle of Baghdad and how much that puts civilians at risk, how doctors are trying to cope, and we'll try to give you an audio map of the neighborhoods of the Iraqi capital. If you have questions about what's happening today or about the city of Baghdad, give us a call. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. First, Craig Nelson, who reports for Cox Newspapers, is good enough to join us by phone from Baghdad. And Craig, I know it's been a long day.
Hi, Neil. Yes, it has been. I see journalists are normally a pretty jaded lot, but there are so many, many in tears tonight in both frustration and disbelief at the U.S. explanation for the deaths of two journalists in this hotel this morning. Four journalists were standing on the 15th floor of a balcony and watching the progress of U.S. troops moving up the west bank of the Tigris about a mile and a half away. And suddenly a turret on an M1A1 Abrams tank turned the direction of the hotel and blasted away, hitting the side of the building and sending a big sheet of concrete and metal toward the journalist. One was immediately killed. The rest were taken to the hospital. Another died there. And still a third is in critical condition tonight and in very bad shape. So the U.S. quickly explained that they had seen sniper fire and possibly someone shooting an RPG from the hotel, but no reporters at the hotel heard any sort of that kind of fire coming from the hotel. Furthermore, an RPG has a range of about 1,000 feet. A sniper rifle has a range of maybe 2,500 feet, and the tanks were, as I said, about a mile and a quarter away. So there's an incredible amount of anger and on the part of journalists. There was one journalist who told me tonight, an Italian journalist, said that the person who fired that tank shell should be court-martialed immediately.
I wonder what this has done to your ability or willingness to look out the windows and stand on balconies and follow what's happening right in front of you.
Oh, I'm sure we'll keep doing that because we're inveterate reporters and we want to keep monitoring what's going on, and we've got a lot invested in the story, and we'll continue to do it. But it has cast a pall over all our work, and I haven't seen in my own experience reporters so distraught before.
And from everything you've heard, there is no way to, well, no one has seen any sign of what the U.S. military says was sniper fire or perhaps RPG fire originating from the hotel.
Absolutely. There was a photographer on top of the building who was shooting photographs of the battle firefight going on across the river. But no one heard any sniper fire. There were not even any American forces in the neighborhood. There wasn't any active shooting anywhere within a mile radius of the hotel. So there's a great deal of they just don't understand how this could have happened.
Well, obviously, as personal and as tragic as that incident was, we need to move on to the broader situation of the people of Baghdad and the situation of the Iraqi government, such as it is. Is there any sign the Iraqi government is functioning today?
No, there's still there are no amassing of troops in the streets. This is what has continued to amaze us. There isn't any concentrations of troops at street corners. We see camouflage tanks at certain intersections, but we don't see any of the concentrations of troops and soldiers that we thought we'd see. So there's no organized defense. What was also fascinating about the attack earlier today is that an A-10 Warthog plane came in and laid down a huge line of fire against the planning ministry building, and it was probably at only 1,000 feet. I mean, the planes, U.S. planes, war planes are operating with impunity over the capital. And so there's no organized defense, and they're simply expected to give way quite soon, maybe slowly, but certainly in the next few days.
U.S. troops attacked what they call a leadership target, reportedly in hopes that Saddam Hussein and his two sons were there. There's a restaurant in the Mansour district. Any indication from what you've seen about whether Iraqis think their leader is still alive?
Well, we hear rumors all the time about the whereabouts of Saddam Hussein. We had heard 2 days ago that he was actually in the Mansour district cheerleading and trying to encourage rallying Iraqis to fight. We also, one person swore that he was sitting in his car and looked in his rearview mirror and saw the Iraqi president driving his car around the city. Saddam has been known to drive alone around the city, so it wasn't a rumor that was immediately dismissed. But no, there's no sign of him. He seems to pop up whenever at will, without any surprise at all.
And finally, Craig, what can you tell us about the humanitarian situation? Is there water available, electricity, or what about the situation of the hospitals?
I was at a hospital this morning, and the director of the hospital was saying that they are having their biggest problem right now is the fact that medical staff cannot get to the hospital. The ICRC has set up a system to try to shuttle nurses and doctors to the hospital, but so far, because of the fighting, it hasn't worked very well. An ICRC staff person said that we're in a situation of a permanent wave of mass casualties. He couldn't put any number on those casualties. He just said they were massive. The wards were full of soldiers as well as civilians. We were chased out of the wards where there were many, many soldiers. The doctors simply did not want to see us taking film or taking pictures or taking notes about soldiers, wounded soldiers.
Craig Nelson, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
And good luck. Bye-bye. Craig Nelson reports for Cox Newspapers. He was with us by phone from Baghdad. Joining us now from his office in New York City is independent military analyst Will Arkin. And Bill, good to have you back.
Thank you very much.
In recent days, American troops have taken some locations of symbolic importance, palaces and the like in Baghdad, and now a couple of airports, at least we're told about the second airport today. Do you think that this has changed expectations about the ease of occupying this huge city?
Well, first, I wouldn't call these symbolic. The fact of the matter is that the U.S. military occupies an area of downtown Baghdad that is about a quarter of the size of the island of Manhattan. And there are two fronts, one in the east and one in the west, the one in the west centered around Saddam International Airport, and the one in the east centered around the Rashid Airfield, which is a military airfield, that are moving increasingly towards the center of the city, while the 3rd Infantry Division and the 1st Marines move clockwise and counterclockwise to encircle the capital. So by no means is this symbolic. However, I would also say that it is characteristic of the bypass strategy which the U.S. ground forces have pretty much followed since the beginning, which is to bypass populated areas and to continue in their forward march towards their primary objective, which is the regime in Baghdad. And what I mean by that is that these are huge areas in the center of Baghdad and in the outskirts of Baghdad, yet they are areas in general where the civilian population doesn't live, and they are government quarters where, like the mall, let's say, in downtown Washington, D.C., where few people live and there are lots of government buildings and a lot of open space by which the U.S. military can defend themselves. Ironically, they are operating with the very defense mechanisms that Saddam Hussein created around his palaces in order to defend himself from the Iraqi people.
Now, once the fighting, though, shifts into a densely populated city, even if these particular areas are not densely populated, the character of warfare changes, and it's much more likely for civilians to get caught up in it.
Well, I think we're already seeing a bit of that today, unfortunately, and I think that the deaths of the 3 journalists today is a tiny window into the increasing civilian casualties that we're seeing in the capital. The reality is that there is a very different aesthetic on the part of ground forces and ground soldiers than there is from air forces in terms of how they approach attacking a target. General McChrystal today, speaking from the Pentagon, talked of the inherent right of self-defense on the part of soldiers on the ground. And while I'm sure that whoever was the tank gunner in that tank that shot from the Jumhuriya Bridge to the Palestine Hotel across the river because he perceived that shots were coming from that building, whether they were or they weren't, will get probably a slap on the wrist because it was bad judgment. The fact of the matter is that those ground forces operate under different rules of engagement. Those rules of engagement are self-defense, and they, if they are under attack, which they are from all directions, they can respond to defend themselves. That's very different than a pilot flying 15,000 feet above the skies of Baghdad, where not only can he select the target, but he has an obligation to ensure that he has a positive identification of the target and can select himself not to drop his ordnance if he can't identify the target or if there is something in the area that might indicate to him that he would kill civilians. It is truly a different aesthetic on the part of the air forces and the ground forces as to how they handle these matters. But then again, in the skies over Baghdad right now, no one is shooting at these airplanes, and so therefore, in some ways, you could say they have a little bit more decision-making time in terms of selecting their targets. And on the ground, while I think that this is really a terrific window for us to understand how much the civilian harm is increasing as U.S. forces get into these populated neighborhoods of the capital city, the truth of the matter is that they operate under very different conditions.
Let's see if we can get a quick question in. Henry is on the line with us from Augusta, Georgia.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, you're on the air.
I just had two comments. One by the journalism fellow seemed extremely upset with the deaths of his colleagues. But I thought that's a little bit silly in a way, because in that type of urban madhouse crowded environment with bullets whizzing around all over, I think something like that is bound to happen. So that was my first comment. My second thing, I really wonder how much experience there is with urban warfare in our military. So I don't remember
Well, Bill Arkin could give us a quick answer on that.
Urban conflicts.
I think the answer is very clear, and that is that we don't have any kind of experience other than Mogadishu in Somalia, and that was not good experience of people shooting back at ground forces in populated, dense areas, and we are beginning to see that in Baghdad. The irony is that if the U.S. military is not successful in killing the regime through airstrikes or through its continuing headhunting campaign inside Baghdad, then all of the hard work that has been done up till date to minimize civilian harm and casualties will be undone by the fighting through the streets of this capital city.
Henry, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there.
No, but thank you.
Appreciate the phone call. And Bill Arkin, it's always good to have you join us.
Thank you very much.
Bill Arkin is an independent military analyst, and he joined us on the line from his office in New York. We're talking about the news from Baghdad, and we're taking your calls, 800-989-TALK, 800-989-8255. The email address, totn@npr.org. Coming up next, Baghdad's hospitals confront war. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Waiting for civil affairs officers and troops to come up to do that?
I think probably they probably got the civil affairs people with them. But, you know, this has been, there's been enough resistance that that it may have interfered somewhat with the application of civil affairs methods to public administration. Because, you know, the fact that we have taken relatively low losses kind of obscures the fact that there has been continuing and, in some cases, quite fierce resistance all along the way. And the Marines have certainly experienced an awful lot of it down in the southeast of the city. And if you're involved in a bunch of firefights and taking a lot of indirect fire from mortars and artillery pieces and rocket-propelled grenades, you're probably going to be focused on that to the exclusion of all else until people stop shooting at you.
Rance? I think Rance has left us. But anyway.
No, I'm still here.
Oh, okay.
If I may also, a Wolfowitz was in a briefing and asked by a reporter, weren't U.S. forces aren't U.S. forces had a responsibility to take care of these? And he replied, no, we're an army of liberation, not occupation. But there's also a sharpshooter who was interviewed who said that he had a great day. He killed hundreds of individuals and even said that he killed a female civilian because, quote, she got in my way, unquote. It's this disregard for the civilian population that has me concerned.
Okay, Rance, thanks very much for the phone call.
Well, I think that's loaded up a little on one side here in tone, but I would certainly agree that if there's a lot of rioting and looting going on in Basra, that I think it's the responsibility of the British forces down there, and some of our Marines are down there as well, to stop that. There's no point in letting these people wreck the city because they've been taken out from underneath all this pressure, and order has to be restored. There's no doubt about that.
Colonel Lang, hang with us for a moment, if you would. Joining us now by phone from Salamia in Kuwait is Dr. Jim Tulloch. He's Regional Health Coordinator for the World Health Organization and the UN Humanitarian Health Coordinator. Good of you to speak with us. We know it's late there.
Good evening.
What can you tell us about conditions inside Baghdad?
Well, obviously we are very concerned about conditions inside Baghdad and the safety and health of the population of Baghdad. We have to remember that the majority of the population there are women and children, are not fighters. We have already casualty figures that are in the hundreds for deaths, in the thousands for injuries. Of course, it's very difficult to get information from inside Baghdad at the moment. In fact, the exact numbers don't really matter very much. There is no acceptable or unacceptable levels of civilian casualties. That is to say, there's no level which is acceptable. These numbers are made up of children, women, adults,
mm-hmm.
children with burns, children with fractures, children with amputations. There's a rising number, and it's a great concern to us.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And actually, if you would be so good, sir, we have a question from a listener, if you would be willing to answer it.
I'll try.
All right. Lynn joins us now on the line from Richmond, Maine.
Hi.
Hi.
My question is as follows. What can individual Americans do to assist in getting humanitarian aid to the people of Iraq?
Dr. Jim Tulloch, do you have an answer?
Well, I think one thing to keep in mind is that humanitarian assistance should be delivered by people who are expert in the delivery of humanitarian assistance, and that means experienced, or it means in the first instance, I would have to say the United Nations and its various organizations, the World Health Organization, UNICEF, for example. It includes the Red Cross. It includes some NGOs that have good experience and good capacity in delivery of humanitarian assistance. So support to these institutions, financial support to them, or urging your congressman to be supportive of the UN and of these sorts of organizations is one thing that you can do. One thing you should not do is send drugs randomly or send things randomly that have not been requested. This is not helpful.
Lynn, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Dr. Tulloch, can you tell us how soon you think it will be when the security situation will allow you to get into Iraq?
Well, I certainly can't answer that question. I think you all have... watching also the news and hearing the news and realize that the situation is still very unstable. We, the United Nations, hopes to return to the three northern governorates quite soon, and also some parts of the south are already accessible for assessment missions and some limited humanitarian assistance, and we're hoping that other areas of the south will be also accessible quite soon. Of course, Baghdad and some other cities are much more difficult to predict, and it's precisely those places that we're particularly concerned about, as they are encircled and as it's difficult for humanitarian assistance to get inside the cities. The toll on the civilian population is increasing day by day.
Dr. Tulloch, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks so much for being with us. More with Colonel Lang after a break. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Here on Talk of the Nation, well, we're trying to keep you up to date as best we can on Baghdad. We're trying to establish contact with reporters there. As you can imagine, communications are difficult at the best of times. It's not the best of times. We'll do our best. Still with us, and by no means second best, is a retired Colonel Patrick Lang. He's at his home in Virginia, former Special Forces officer who served as Chief Middle East Analyst for the Defense Intelligence Agency. And Colonel Lang, I was wondering if you could... This is urban warfare, and we were talking earlier about what experience U.S. forces have had with this and what training they may have undergone. And can you fill that out a little bit? What has gone on since, I guess, Mogadishu was the last time people remember urban combat?
There's been a lot of emphasis on training for urban warfare since then, but in both the Army and the Marine Corps. And there are various training centers around that have mock-up towns in which procedures for conducting an attack or defense in a built-up area are practiced intensively. So these fellows have had a lot of experience at this, really. I mean, the last time we fought a big fight in an urban area was probably Hue during the Vietnam War. But there has been a lot of training for this. However, when you're over in the 3rd Infantry Division area, something interesting is going on. It's called the 3rd Infantry Division, but it's really a medium-heavy armored division with lots of tanks and Bradley personnel carriers, and these guys have a tradition of mounted warfare. They move around a lot very fast with a lot of firepower, and it usually thought that you can't do that in cities, but they seem to be rewriting the book here, and they're handling their situation in the middle of Baghdad without any trouble at all. Of course, the part of the town that they're in has a lot of open space in it.
Mm-hmm. One of the reactions you seem to get a lot is from military professionals who look at what they've done, and as you have, say that this is they're trying some new things, and in fact that things are going extremely rapidly. And then from perhaps regular civilians who are just shocked at the violence that is being used in as we've been described, a large city.
Well, they don't understand what war is really like. You know, there's a great tendency to start to equate military operations and soldiers with policemen and SWAT teams and things like this. And it isn't like that at all. I mean, the mission of ground military force, is to close with and destroy the enemy. They're trained for that all their lives. Their psychology is that. They're not interested in arresting people unless there's some very specific reason for doing that. They're going to go in there and destroy the enemy force, and the way they do it is by fire and maneuver. And to do less than that is to deprive them of everything they've ever trained to do and to place them in great harm. In fact, I think
that they are going to quite extraordinary lengths to try to injure as few Iraqi civilians as possible. But when you're throwing around that much ordnance in a big built-up area with a large civilian population, it is inevitable that you're going to hurt a bunch of people, and it's regrettable, but that's just the way it is.
Let's get another call. Larry joins us from Maslin, Ohio. Larry, you're on the air. Larry's listening to his radio and not realizing that we take these calls on delay.
I'm sorry. I'm just was headed to turn off the radio.
Hopefully thanks very much.
In the background.
Okay.
Yes. My question was, the photographer that had the camera there that was shot by the Al Jazeera photographer, I'm wondering if from a distance from a tank with maybe a flat screen TV type device, that may have looked like a shoulder held rocket launcher.
I don't think they would actually have put fire on that building, which is pretty clearly a hotel. I mean, a lot of balconies and things, unless they thought they were receiving fire from that part of the building. And I know that one of your earlier correspondents said that the people in the hotel hadn't heard anybody firing, but I'm quite sure that this tank commander, whoever he was, would not have done that unless he thought this was justified. He had to protect his crew and his vehicle. But in fact, you know, it's very interesting what the Arab press is calling these people killed from Al Jazeera. They're calling them Shaheed, which means martyr, and Mujahid, which means holy warrior. And these two things imply that they were in some sense combatants. So you have to wonder exactly what was going on there.
And Larry, just to be clear, the incident at the hotel did not involve Al Jazeera. That was a separate incident, an apparent air attack on the Al Jazeera office. At least that's what, according to Al Jazeera.
Oh, I see. I'm sorry, I got that confused.
Yeah, there was just different reporters.
About the reporters that
right,
were yeah. targeted.
Right. Okay. Thanks very much.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go to Roger, who joins us from Vancouver, Washington.
Hi.
Hi, you're on the air.
I was just wanting to agree with your last speaker, I guess, that I feel that they're doing an awful lot on the troops to minimize casualties in the civilian area. My son just got out of the Army in December, and talking with him about it, he said they train for that every week. He served in Kosovo and its civilian populations, and that it also seems that what I'm seeing is the most fighting is going on with the paramilitary forces in the Shiite areas of the cities, in Basra and in Baghdad, and that they're making it harder, you know, to enlist the civilian population because that's where all the battling is going on. Is that any way close to true?
Colonel Lang?
I don't think there's any fighting going on anywhere except in response to resistance. And resistance means people shooting at you with artillery pieces, rocket-propelled grenades, machine guns, and things of that kind. And the Iraqis are showing a lot of courage in this. They'll come right up to our armored vehicles in order to have a go at us, and then the troops are going to blow them away. On the eastern axis where the Marines are, there's been a tremendous amount of resistance. I'm not sure if those are really Shiites or not. There are Sunnis as well that live over in that area, as well as paramilitary units, and I think it's a mixed picture of who's fighting us in terms of various militia groups and police and fragments of military units. But there sure is a lot of it, and it doesn't look like it's going to go away too soon. It's too bad we don't have some more troops up there.
Roger, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Appreciate the phone call. And Colonel Lang, we thank you again for allowing us to impose on your time.
Anytime.
Patrick Lang is retired from the United States Army, and he was speaking with us from his home in Virginia. He was a chief Middle East analyst for the Defense Intelligence Agency during the Gulf War 12 years ago. Most of the phones in Baghdad have been dead for more than a week now, leaving Iraqi Americans with very little direct news of their loved ones in that city. Over the past few weeks, we've been checking in with Imam Sayed Mustafa Al-Kazwini in Pomona, California, about how he and his community are coping with this war. And Imam, good of you to join us again.
Glad to be with you, Neil.
Have you been able to get in touch with your family and friends inside Iraq?
No, unfortunately, for the last 7 or 8 we were not able to be in touch with them since most of the communication lines are down.
Mm-hmm. What were they able to tell you about conditions where they were before the phones went out?
Conditions were harsh in some of the cities. Of course, they were anticipating the American troops, especially in the cities of Najaf and Karbala, and this was before the liberation of these two cities, they were telling us, so far it is peaceful now, we don't know what will happen next. My relatives in Baghdad, of course, they were very worried about the continuous bombings and raids on this city day and night, and they were not in a very good shape.
As you mentioned, your relatives in Najaf and Karbala waiting for what happened next, that's already happened there, and it must be agony not being able to find out what has happened to them.
That's right. It's a sense of frustration among my family and my community that they have no news about their loved ones. They do not know about their fate. They hope that they are fine, they are okay. We pray for their safety. It's a mixed feeling of, a jubilation for the liberation of these cities, this reign of terror caused by Saddam Hussein came to an end. A chapter of humiliation for the Iraqis is finally coming to an end soon. Nothing can bring more joy and happiness to the heart of the ordinary Iraqis than seeing Saddam Hussein being handcuffed and driven away from his bunker soon.
This is Syed Mustafa Al-Kazwini, an imam in Pomona, California, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And I wanted to ask you and other people who are from Iraq, when you watch TV and see these places that you have to remember, this is, at least to some degree, your city. Is what's going on better or worse than you had imagined or feared?
No, when I looked at the images coming from Najaf and Karbala, my worries in the past was about the religious sites, the shrines, the holy shrines that has been there for many centuries now, for the people who are inside them, for the worshippers, for the ordinary people in the streets. And then when we saw the images coming just 2-3 days ago that they were safe, of course, it gave us a sense of comfort. But again, when we see images of destruction, infants, babies, women in the hospitals, lack of medicine, we see images of civilian destructions. Of course, it brings tears and shock and sadness to us.
You're obviously in touch with the Iraqi community in your area. What is the mood amongst those people?
It's a mixed mood, in fact. Some of them are jubilant. They are going to go home soon after a long, long separation, almost three decades of separation from their loved ones, from their hometown. Others are very anxious, very worried. I am very anxious about the future in Iraq. What will happen next? What is the next step? Is it going to be a long military occupation for Iraq, or is it going to be a smooth transition of power to the Iraqi people? So it's a mixed feeling.
As you know, people who are exiles, when they return after a long period of time, often the people who have stuck it out, whether, they may not have had a choice, but the people who were there all those times are somewhat resentful of people coming in as they see it from outside, people who have had it, as they see it, easier than they did, suffering under, in this case, Saddam, or in other cases, certainly this happened in several cases in Eastern Europe, of exiles returning and expecting to have a role in that society and being somewhat resented by the people who stayed. Is that a factor? Do you talk to your community about that, the people who are planning to go back?
Obviously, this is one of the factors, but let me make it clear to you, Neil, and to the listeners, that we have about 4 million Iraqis living in diaspora. Almost each and every family in Iraq, they have some people who live in exile. Maybe most of the family, maybe one or two members of the family. They understand our situation. They understand why we left Iraq. We could not stay in Iraq any longer. Our life was at risk. We could face death and punishment and execution, as it happened to many members of my own family, about 15 members of them who were killed by Saddam Hussein. They understand our situation. They know we are working for the liberation of Iraq when we live abroad, when we are in exile. We are not just sitting idle here doing nothing. We are working to liberate our country and go back to them. So there is a sense of...
From his home in Virginia, he was a chief Middle East analyst for the Defense Intelligence Agency during the Gulf War 12 years ago. Most of the phones in Baghdad have been dead for more than a week now, leaving Iraqi Americans with very little direct news of their loved ones in that city. Over the past few weeks, we've been checking in with Imam Sayed Mustafa Al-Kazwini in Pomona, California, about how he and his community are coping with this war. And Imam, good of you to join us again.
Glad to be with you, Neil.
Have you been able to get in touch with your family and friends inside Iraq?
No, unfortunately, for the last 7 or 8 we were not able to be in touch with them since most of the communication lines are down.
Mm-hmm. What were they able to tell you about conditions where they were before the phones went out?
Conditions were harsh in some of the cities. Of course, they were anticipating the American troops, especially in the cities of Najaf and Karbala, and this was before the liberation of these two cities. They were telling us, so far it is peaceful now, we don't know what will happen next. My relatives in Baghdad, of course, they were very worried about the continuous bombings and raids on this city day and night, and they were not in a very good shape.
As you mentioned, your relatives in Najaf and Karbala waiting for what happened next, that's already happened there, and it must be agony not being able to find out what has happened to them.
That's right. It's a sense of frustration among my family and my community that they have no news about their loved ones. They do not know about their fate. They hope that they are fine, they are okay. We pray for their safety. It's a mixed feeling of, you know, a jubilation for the liberation of these cities, this reign of terror caused by Saddam Hussein came to an end, a chapter of humiliation for the Iraqis is finally coming to an end soon. Nothing can bring more joy and happiness to the heart of the ordinary Iraqis than seeing Saddam Hussein being handcuffed and driven away from his bunker soon.
This is Sayed Mustafa Al-Kazwini, an imam in Pomona, California, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And I wanted to ask you and other people who are from Iraq, when you watch TV and see these places that you have to remember, this is, at least to some degree, your city. Is what's going on better or worse than you had imagined or feared?
No, when I looked at the images coming from Najaf and Karbala, my worries in the past was about the religious sites, the shrines, the holy shrines that has been there for many centuries now, for the people who are inside them, for the worshippers, for the ordinary people in the streets. And then when we saw the images coming just 2 or 3 days ago that they were safe, of course, it gave us a sense of comfort. But again, when we see images of destruction, infants, babies, women in the hospitals, lack of medicine, we see images of civilian destructions. Of course, it brings tears and shock and sadness to us.
You're obviously in touch with the Iraqi community in your area. What is the mood amongst those people?
It's a mixed mood, in fact. Some of them are jubilant. They are going to go home soon after a long, long separation, almost three decades of separation from their loved ones, from their hometown. Others are very anxious, very worried. I am very anxious about the future in Iraq. What will happen next? What is the next step? Is it going to be a long military occupation for Iraq, or is it going to be a smooth transition of power to the Iraqi people? So it's a mixed feeling.
As you know, people who are exiles, when they return after a long period of time, often the people who have stuck it out, whether, you know, they may not have had a choice, but the people who were there all those times are somewhat resentful of people coming in as they see it from outside, people who have had it, as they see it, easier than they did, suffering under, in this case, Saddam, or in other cases, certainly this happened in several cases in Eastern Europe, of exiles returning and expecting to have a role in that society and being somewhat resented by the people who stayed. Is that a factor? Do you talk to your community about that, the people who are planning to go back?
Obviously, this is one of the factors, but let me make it clear to you, Neil, and to the listeners, that we have about 4 million Iraqis living in diaspora. Almost each and every family in Iraq, they have some people who live in exile. Maybe most of the family, maybe one or two members of the family. They understand our situation. They understand why we left Iraq. We could not stay in Iraq any longer. Our life was at risk. We could face death and punishment and execution, as it happened to many members of my own family, about 15 members of them who were killed by Saddam Hussein. They understand our situation. They know we are working for the liberation of Iraq when we live abroad, when we are in exile. We are not just sitting idle here doing nothing. We are working to liberate our country and go back to them. So there is a sense of harmony and understanding between the people who live in exile and the people who are still in Iraq.
Well, what about you? What are your plans? What's next for you?
My plan is to go back to Iraq, as soon as possible, when it is safe, when I can get access. I want to see my country, my home. The last time I saw Iraq was in 1979. I want to search for the fate of those who were imprisoned, members of my family. I know some of them were executed, to go and search for their graves, to pay tribute to them, to work for the reconstruction of my country, the infrastructure of Iraq, where there is much need there in the social field, in the educational field, in the humanitarian field. We have plenty of orphans and widows and illiteracy, and every problem is going on right now in Iraq. So I am part of that nation, and I have to go back and to help my own country and my own people there.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us, and we hope we'll be able to keep in touch and see how it goes for you.
Thank you, Neil.
Imam Sayed Mustafa Al-Kazwini joined us from his home in Pomona, California. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.